It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, filling in for Veronica Rickert. Coming up later in the program, we'll be celebrating National One-Hit Wonder Day by talking about some of our favorites from past decades.
First, we talked to State Representative Dean Knutson on the show last week about two police transparency bills he's proposing. One bill would require departments to develop written policies on the use of no-knock raids. Another would mandate the departments collect data on their use of SWAT teams.
Representative Knutson says these proposals would help the public understand how their local law enforcement agencies are operating, but some law enforcement officials have expressed skepticism over what these bills would do.
Jim Palmer joins us now. He's the executive director of the Wisconsin Professional Police Association. Jim, welcome back to the show.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me on.
Let's start with no-knock searches, Jim. That's the target of this first bill. First, can you give us a sense of how common this practice is and when it gets used by law enforcement officials?
Well, these are very highly scrutinized instances, and they're not used, I think, as much as some people suspect because they are so highly scrutinized. But first, just to take a half step back, it's important to note that you know our organization, the WPPA, is the state's largest law enforcement group. We fully support transparency in law enforcement and in adding additional transparency in law enforcement. I think that's an important place for me to start. With respect to the no-knock search warrants, these are not used as much as people believe, although there is no, statewide reporting of that. But in talking with officers around the state, these really aren't used that often because they're so highly scrutinized. And they are really evaluated by judges on a case-by-case basis, and they are extraordinarily fact-specific. And, you know, the judicial system, over the course of 20 years or better, have really struggled to come up with an established and uniform set of guidelines, and that's really been a challenge for law enforcement across the country. And what this bill essentially is asking law enforcement to do is that which the courts have been unable to do in two decades. And we think that because these situations are so fact-specific, that it really is going to undermine the public understanding of when these no-knock search warrants are utilized. And in that way, I think that the legislation really is undermined by its intent.
Representative Knutson said, hey, some departments have written policies, which is all they're asking for. They have their own written policies on no-knock police raids. So what would be the problem in requiring other departments to follow suit and still be able to craft their own policies, not one size fits all?
Absolutely. Well, you know, the author of the bill is misinformed. Because while there are agencies that have policies that may have the words no-knock search warrant in them, they basically specifically provide that those are determinations that are made by a judge. And so this notion that there are agencies throughout the state that already have them, anyone can, I'm sure, find them, and they will find little clarification and gain a little understanding as to the specific criterion that are considered when these delicate cases and decisions have to be made. Just to give you one example, some courts across the country have said that when an officer makes or officers make an entry such as this, that once they enter a premises, that waiting 3 to 5 seconds before they announce is not enough time. On the other hand, other courts have said that waiting 15 to 20 seconds is okay. So within that range of 5 to 15 seconds, you have a broad spectrum of what is acceptable under the law, and it really is very fact-specific. It depends on how the subjects inside a residence react. It depends on what law enforcement officers know at the time that they request a no-knock search warrant. And so it really is hard for any agency, again, to promulgate a policy that, that answers a lot of the questions that the courts it has frankly been unable to answer for law enforcement for about 20 years now.
Well, do you think if we knew every time a no-knock entry was used and there was some way to collect that data statewide from every department, we might get the information we need to say, okay, here's where it works, here's maybe where it needs tweaking, and then come up with a policy?
Well, you know, we don't have any problem with general reporting on how often they are used. That is not, really the problem. The problem is, asking agencies, as this bill does, to come up with a set of guidelines that would somehow improve and clarify the general public's understanding of the, you know, the myriad of legal considerations and fact-specific considerations that currently a judge has to evaluate. I mean, really, in a lot of ways, that portion of the bill really appears to micromanage law enforcement and be an attempt to supplant the judgment of local elected judges. And we're not sure that's an appropriate public policy.
Talking to Jim Palmer from the Wisconsin Professional Police Association about legislation from Republican Assembly Representative Dean Knutson, some new requirements on local police departments. We've been talking so far about no-knock raids. Jim, let's turn to the SWAT team legislation, reporting when and how SWAT teams are deployed in police situations. Tell us a little more about that proposal.
Absolutely. Well, that legislation would require every municipality in the state that has a police agency with a SWAT team to report annually to the Department of Justice on how often they're used. And I'll stop there because it's important to know that our organization, we're not opposed to that. You know, we think that there would be a benefit in reporting that information and the public having that made available to them. Where it's the second half of the bill that creates some concerns for us, in that it also requires reporting of the outcomes of those SWAT team deployments. And our concern with that is, you know, if a law enforcement agency reports how often its SWAT team is used, and they're also reporting, let's say, just as one example, the number of arrests, you know, if the two aren't equal, we're concerned that there will be, you know, quite a few people that will unreasonably draw the conclusion that those SWAT deployments were inappropriate or weren't called for. And, you know, we think that anything that goes, any kind of dialogue or discourse that goes down that road neglects the fact that law enforcement agencies don't have the benefit of hindsight. And they make these decisions to use SWAT teams, which have been extraordinarily beneficial not only to keeping the public safe, but officers safe. These decisions to deploy those teams are really made, you know, based on the best information that they have at the time. So there's only one state in the nation currently that has a law like this, and it's Utah. And I think, again, while general reporting of SWAT team deployments isn't an issue, some of the ancillary information that this bill also requires, we think, again, would lead to greater confusion. And it distorts the reality of the law enforcement profession.
But, Jim, I mean, one possibility, if, as you say, those numbers don't match up, the raids and the arrests or the findings of weapons or drugs or that sort of thing, one possible explanation might be that, hey, maybe we don't need to use SWAT teams as much, and we don't know at all if we don't collect this information.
Well, I think, you know, that, again, you get into a problem based on, you know, first of all, to take half a step back, any municipality with a SWAT team today can already require this information. And nothing prevents them from being able to do that. And the fact that they don't, I think, indicates that maybe this isn't as big a concern on a statewide basis as some would seem to suggest. But again, I think we just need to be very, considerate of the fact that law enforcement officers deploy these SWAT teams based upon the best information that they have, and that the outcomes should not evaluate evaluative in terms of whether or not they were necessary in the first place.
Jim, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me on.
That's Jim Palmer, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Professional Police Association. Joined us to talk about concerns over two legislative proposals aimed at law enforcement agencies and reporting in the state. Remember that one song by that one band? What were they called again? Actually, I remember this one. Flock of Seagulls in Iran. One of my favorites.
And, you know, tomorrow is National One Hit Wonder Day. Who knew? And we'd like to hear from you about this musical phenomenon. What's your all-time favorite one-hit wonder? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. Extra credit if you post yourself with a picture of yourself with Flock of Seagulls hair.
Definitely. Jonathan Pollock joins us now to talk about these artists who made that big splash and then faded away. He's a pop culture expert and history instructor at Madison Area Technical College. John, welcome back.
Good to be back, Rob. Thanks for calling me.
Let's lock down this term here. What makes a band, an artist, a one-hit wonder, John?
Well, lockdown is going to be kind of a tough target to hit. Different people define it differently. So there's some people who'd say, well, a one-hit wonder, it's got to be a band that had a song go to number one on the pop charts and never had another hit afterwards. I think the way it's more commonly used, because most people don't carry like 50 years of Billboard in their heads, so they know exactly what mm-hmm. song peaked at number one and what song peaked at number two or number 10 or whatever. It's a band that had like one song that at least made the charts and got significant airplay at one point in time, and then they were never heard from again. So I usually go with the second option on that one.
So the shortest number one song of all time is also a one-hit wonder, and from the early years of rock and roll. Let's take a listen.
So there was a cover version of that was a hit too, but Stay by Maurice Williams and the Zodiacs. John, that I think is one of your favorites. What are some of your other favorite early rock and roll one-hit wonders?
From that period, one of my other favorites is Telstar by the Tornados. It was a British band. They were produced by a guy named Joe Meek, who was a really influential producer. And it's an early synthesizer, is what it is. It was like a synthesizer that took up, I think, the better part of a room. but that's kind of a neat one. I think it's from like 1962, I want to say, 61. So from real early on, I think that's one of my favorites.
So one hit wonders are not unique to one specific decades, but this is not just me, even though I'm a child of the 80s, that decade really seems to have been a ripe time for one-hit wonders. What are some of your favorites from the 80s?
Oh, from the 80s. So there's Pop Music by M, which I guess is 79, but I think it was like 80 when I first heard it. I'm blanking on what I wrote down.
Well, we have a couple here. We have In a Big Country.
I thought that one was interesting because kind of like the Flock of Seagulls cut that you played at the beginning of the show. I remember hearing at least one other big country song, a song called Fields of Fire that I thought was big enough to get on the charts, but evidently wasn't. And Flock of Seagulls, they had a Space Age Love Song was kind of the follow-up to Iran. I guess that one didn't actually hit. It just got some radio play, or at least the station I was listening to in the early 80s was playing it. Those are a couple of them. Devo, which is like one of my favorite bands of all time. I think I've talked about my love of Devo before when I've been on your show.
I'm with you there, John.
They are like Whip It was their only hit. I've got like 8 Devo albums at home. There has to be more hits than that, but evidently no. Evidently it's just Whip It and then nothing else.
Let's give a listen to the first one we mentioned, In a Big Country by Big Country. Smile away from anybody's face, and that's a desperate way to look for someone who is still a child in a big country dream. And that, John, like a lot of, I think, one-hit wonders, even though it was a one-hit wonder, it really sounds like the 80s. There were a lot of other bands that sounded a little like that, and some of the other ones we talked about.
Yeah, and that's one of the other things about one-hit wonders that gets kind of elusive if you really think about them a lot, is that oftentimes you've got songs that had a whole bunch of songs by the same producer. And so a producer kind of puts his or sometimes her like distinctive stamp on a song. There's like a way that they mix it, or they've got some kind of instrumental element that's really theirs, and it shows up on a lot of songs, even though each band only gets one hit. In the case of Big Country, Big Country was the first of several songs I can think of that have like guitars tuned like bagpipes. That thing that sounds kind of like a bagpipe on there is actually a guitar through some kind of pedal or something like that, some kind of effects pedal. And you got other bands in the 80s that had that guitar as bagpipe thing going.
Oh, yeah, I get it now. Thank you. You've just educated me, John. It does sound like that.
All this time you didn't figure this out?
No.
Come on, man.
Wow.
Well, Rob and I had an interesting conversation earlier because we found out that we were both big Thomas Dolby fans, and Rob was really quite jealous because I actually got to see Thomas Dolby open for the Eurythmics back in the day, and She Blinded Me with Science is such an awesome song.
Here it is. And that, like, Devo, I mean, there's a lot of catalog there of really good stuff that was maybe influential, but in the pop crowd, just that one big hit that people remember,
so,
John.
So Dolby's Hyperactive never made the charts, or nothing off Howard the Duck soundtrack?
I think people tried to forget Howard the Duck, but yeah, Hyperactive, I remember seeing it on MTV. It was not a big hit, though. I don't think that's one that people remember like they remember Blinded
right.
by
yeah.
Science.
Yeah, no. That one, Blinded with Science, was huge. And Thomas Dolby, someone else, he did a lot of producing, so there are a lot of other bands that have like elements of his sound on it. And I think that, Rob, contributes to what you think of as that as the quintessential 80s song that Thomas Dolby played on or produced lots of records in the 1980s.
We're talking with Jonathan Pollack, a history instructor and pop culture expert at Madison Area Technical College. We are talking about one-hit wonders.
And now to your calls at 800-642-1234. Kathy is with us in Waterford. Kathy, hi.
Hi, how are you guys?
Good. What do you got for us in the one-hit wonder line?
Well, I'm going to date myself, but back when I was a kid, the DeFranco family, Heartbeat, It's a Love Beat, stuck with me all these years. And I know I had their album, but I don't know if any other ones made it to the chart.
I will admit, I don't know this one. John, you?
Yeah, no, I know the song, and I'm kind of in the same boat as the caller here. I can't think of another song by the DeFranco family that charted, but Heartbeat, It's a Love Beat. Yeah, it was like early 70s, I want to say. It was a really big hit, and I don't know of anything else that they did.
Another one from the 70s. I think you shared this one with us, Brother Louie by the Stories. Here it is. And this one, I remember distinctly the song, and if you quiz me, I would not say the band The Stories or the original, I guess, is a cover by the band Hot Chocolate, John.
Yeah, no, that was not one on my list. But yeah, the song I remember really well. What I remember most about it is that I remember hearing about that song, and then I heard the song Louie Louie, another great one-hit wonder. Like, I heard about that later, and that's what I thought Louie Louie was. But no,
nope.
It's a completely different song.
Well, and apparently Brother Louie is being used as the opening theme for Louis C.K.'s TV show, Louie.
Oh, okay.
Oh, sure. Okay, that makes sense.
Well, let's go back to our callers. Sue is with us in Wauwatosa. Sue, hi.
Hi. I was also looking at the 70s, and there's a song, Spirit in the Sky, by Greenbaum.
Yeah, Norman Greenbaum.
Norman Greenbaum.
Yeah.
Yes. And it's always been one of my favorites. My sisters that are 12 and 14 years younger than me tease me constantly, but I just love Spirit in the Sky.
Yeah, that's one you hear on classic rock stations still all the time, John. And yeah, nothing else by Norman Greenbaum made the charts. One thing I wanted to bring up is people make fun of one-hit wonders. You and I have been in bands, John, that are and remain zero-hit wonders. So
yeah.
Maybe it's not such a bad thing to have that one hit.
No, I was thinking about that very thing when you asked me to be on this show. That it's such a random thing. You know, there are lots of people. Who you get a band together and they sound really tight and you play out, maybe release a record, and then nobody buys it. And then just somehow something gets picked up and it just becomes huge. And I think one of the things that maybe accounts for one-hit wonders is you have a band of talented people who don't really plan on this happening, like nobody does, and they're just all of a sudden kind of pulled out of their element. They're you know, they go on a national tour or a world tour out of whatever town they started in. And they're just, like, the pressure of trying to match up to that is immense. That they've got this one monster hit, and everybody says, okay, great, what are you going to do next? And they're like, oh, we'll go in the studio and figure it out. And then they can't do it. You can't, you know, have lightning strike twice. So, yeah, I think it's a huge accomplishment for a band to be, you know, for a song like Spirit in the Sky, where automatically, I'm sure most of our audience is, you know, the opening riff is going through their head and all that. That's huge to be able to pull that off.
I'm just singing the riff. We didn't pull that one, yeah.
Well, I think one of the one-hit wonders that has... developed a completely new life of its own is Rick Astley, Never Gonna Give You Up, because people will trick people into going to a website and get Rickrolled, which is hearing the song. So let's take a listen to that.
Tell you how I'm feeling.
Songs can make comebacks in weird ways, especially in the age of the internet now. Old is new again, John.
Yeah, no, it's easier than ever to call up old songs and just be able to access them instantly. that that before it would be, you know, you'd have to have a copy of it or call a radio station and have it played, hope that they had it on hand. But that makes it possible for anything to be kind of cannibalized and come back. And that song is the best example, that it was just a completely random sort of viral thing that took over a big chunk of the internet.
Let's go back to the phones, and Mike in Eau Claire is up next. Hi, Mike.
Hi there. Yeah, I was going to bring up the song Mambo No. 5 by Lou Bega. And then I think it's so funny, too, how he sold out so bad on that song. I mean, he sold it to Hardee's, different car companies.
Hey, milk it while you can.
Yeah,
thank
exactly.
you so much.
No,
that's
he knew it was going to be a one-hit wonder. So.
That's one we were joking about before the show. John, can you leave us with one more favorite all-time one-hit wonder?
Another favorite, I don't know if you've got that on hand there, but it would be Rasputin by Boney M., which is a song. It turned up in one of those like Dance Dance Revolution kind of videos.
Oh.
My kid was like singing it around the house, and I was like, that's a total one-hit wonder from 1978. How do you know that? And
brilliant.
It turns out it's in a dance video game. That was one that you talk about things coming back in unexpected ways. I think that's a great example.
Well, John, thanks a lot for joining us today.
And thank you once again.
That's Jonathan Pollock from Madison Area Technical College. We'll go out with another Wisconsin one-hit wonder, Timbuk3. This is Central Time. Two major business scandals are all over the news this week. German automaker Volkswagen finds itself in hot water after it was discovered that the company was illegally installing software to evade standards for reducing smog. Also, the former owner of a peanut company in Georgia was sentenced to 28 years in prison for his role in a salmonella outbreak that killed 9 people and sickened hundreds.
Both cases raise ethical questions over why companies misbehave and how business is done these days, as well as what all of this means for consumers who might be wondering just who they can trust.
Praveen Parbodia joins us now. He's a professor of international management at UW-Whitewater, and he's the co-author of the book Business Ethics. Praveen, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for the invitation.
So let's start with Volkswagen. They have had a rough week so far on the stock market, in the international press. Can you start by summing up what's happened lately?
What we are seeing right now is repercussions at an international level. You know, we see that now other countries are seeing that they've tricked the software in those situations as well. And so I think if we try to understand what's happening with them, the implications are very far-ranging. We hear of lawsuits in England. We hear of other investigations in Europe and so on. So I don't know where really it stops. Because, for example, the parallel with the Toyota case, at least it was confined to the U.S., but this is taking an amazingly global dimension.
Looking at this one, this isn't one of those ethical gray areas. I think most people agree. Someone in the company knowingly did something to avoid the law, avoid the standards. What motivates companies to bypass the rules like this, veer off into illegal, in this case, and what a lot of people consider unethical territory?
You know, this is just a big surprise for me, actually. I've taught business ethics for the last 15 years, and every year I tell my students, you know, this is the last scandal. Hopefully we won't hear of anything more. But, you know, what we see, I think, in this case is just a desire to sell more cars. And if they had the software on the cars, that, you know, they would not have been performing as fast. And, you know, just in that desire to sell more cars. And again, I think it's just profits before anything else. And the most surprising thing is, you know, Volkswagen has a very strong reputation for its engineering, for its products. But so this is very surprising.
This is a widespread thing. You'd think there might be a fear of being caught. Even if ethics didn't deter you from doing this, the risk would. So what does that tell you about the business climate at Volkswagen, maybe in general?
You know, I would say that companies, I think, are much more aware of the ethical implications of what they are doing. I mean, of course, there's cost and benefits of any decision, and there are thoughts about, you know, is it something that's for us to go through, even though it's unethical, and should we do it and bear the consequences? So I don't know if we would, you know, I would be comfortable saying that the business climate now is very negative, is going towards the darker side. I would say that companies are very aware, and I'm hopeful that this is an isolated case, because I think the Department of Justice too is taking lots of steps to, now we see that there's the Yates memo that came out that places responsibility not just on companies, but also with people within companies who are acting unethically. So I don't know if it's really kind of a implies businesses in general.
And in this case, the CEO this week, Martin Winterkorn, resigned from Volkswagen. He said he hadn't been aware of wrongdoing on his or the company's part. So if he's right, if he didn't know, is his resignation the right move?
Yes, I think in many ways what we would like to see from any company involved in these situations is honesty and transparency. And I think to some degree Volkswagen is engaged in that. And also, you know, they say it all starts with the top. And for him to resign, I think, sends the message that the company is trying to make changes. Because, again, the parallel is with the Toyota case. And at the beginning, they denied that they were responsible. And I think the consequences for them were much more negative in the long term. So I think him by resigning shows that they understand the magnitude of the problem, and that somebody else, and I hear that the Porsche CEO will be in charge, so hopefully he will come in and make changes so that, you know, these issues are corrected, because they are going to face a very long battle, and having somebody else in place, I think, sends the right message to the market.
I want to give a listen to VW's North America director, Michael Horn, speaking earlier this week at a company event.
Our company was dishonest with the EPA and the California Air Resources Board and with all of you. And in my German words, we have totally screwed up.
So there's that admission you were talking about. We screwed up, he says. So what's the next step? You admit this, you admit it publicly, but how does an organization rebuild its ethical standards and rebuild the trust with the public?
I think the big question for them now is the consumer trust. Ultimately, a company is there because people are buying their products. Again, the good thing about Volkswagen is they have a strong reputation, and I think people respect them for their products. But I think in the long term, they will probably start engaging in PR moves. Probably we saw that with Toyota to maybe have advertising about, you know, how they messed up and that their products are still good and strong. And you know, hopefully in the long term, this will come back, because the textbook example of how companies should deal with, you know, such crisis is the Tylenol case. And what they did was they had a very good public relations kind of campaign, and they, first of all, took responsibility, although it wasn't their direct responsibility. And the second thing they did was they worked on restoring consumer trust. So that will be something. But I think Volkswagen also has a lot of, you know, dealing with governments and the legal aspect of it. I read that they hired the same team that defended British Petroleum in the Gulf of Mexico disaster. And I think, you know, that's going to be big in terms of what they need to do. But I think restoring consumer trust by, again, arguing for the quality of their products and showing what changes are being implemented to make sure that this doesn't happen in the future will be what they would need to do.
Talking to Praveen Parbodia with UW Whitewater, expert on business ethics, about the news from Volkswagen and their apparent effort to cheat emission standards. And also in the news this week, Praveen, is the now defunct Peanut Corporation of America, a CEO joining relatives and fellow managers in prison now after the company shipped salmonella-tainted peanut butter, some damning email, including a note from the executive here saying just ship it for some product that hadn't been completely tested, was known to be at risk. What do you make of that case? What do we learn about right and wrong in the business world there?
You know, I think the message that is being sent to the corporate world is that now we will hold people responsible for such actions. Because if you look at the federal sentencing guidelines and its enforcement, we saw so many cases where people who were behind the actions were able to hide behind some kind of corporate cloak. And now we see that is changing. And I think that's the message that and that should be sending a very clear message now to companies that whoever is being responsible for what is happening could be in jail. And I think that's a significant departure, because if you look at for the longest time for white collar crime, you didn't really see people going to jail for their behaviors. And again, I want to again mention that Yate memo that came out, and they are saying not only will they go after the people who are responsible, but also companies have to show cooperation in terms of investigations by revealing who was behind misconduct. So I think, you know, just like with the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, I think more and more now the enforcement has to do with, instead of saying that a company is responsible, who is behind, who are the people behind the actions, and let's punish them.
This is, as I understand it, unprecedented in a food poisoning case. Felony convictions, more than two decades, prison sentences. Do you expect to see more of that in the future? Do you think this will be a new enforcement mechanism?
I think that will definitely happen. And part of it, too, is, for example, like the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, which was passed to prohibit bribery, that wasn't really being enforced for a while until the last administration. And we saw, you know, many cases being prosecuted and in many cases some settlement is reached. But nevertheless, these companies are, you know, they are getting sued for the kind of infractions of the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. And I think the administration, the Department of Justice, is probably seeing current kind of ethical transgressions in the same line that, you know, we need to punish these people for wrongdoing. We can't just let companies do what they want and not hold them responsible for what's happening.
We're talking with business professor Praveen Parbodia about corporate ethics in light of recent scandals like Volkswagen's Dieselgate, trying to pin down why companies misbehave and how to create more ethical organizations.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What do you think causes companies to veer into unethical waters like these? What can we do to change that? And are you part of an organization or business that prioritizes ethics? If so, how does that play out in your work? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Praveen Parbodia stays with us now. He's a business professor at UW-Whitewater. We're looking at why companies like Volkswagen misbehave and how to create more ethical organizations.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. As a consumer, what's your reaction to these scandals that have been in the news this week at Volkswagen and the now-defunct Peanut Corporation of America? Do you think ethics can and should be prioritized in today's business world? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to our callers. Jim is on the line with us in Rice Lake. Jim, hi, you're on the air.
Afternoon. I teach business law at a Native American community college, and this is an issue we discuss. And I think examples like the most recent one, plus the classic of Enron, and probably the worst of all, the 2008 securities debacle that led to the, you know, our near mini depression, is because of a lack of accountability. The worst event economically since the Great Depression is the 2008 securities frauds. Because the SEC was asleep. Only when businesses fear legal or public accountability will they behave. They are like human beings. They do that to which they can get away with. I'll take my answer off the air.
Jim, thanks a lot for that call. Praveen, that's a pessimistic view. I think it sounds like you're hopeful that ethical behavior can be motivated by more than just fear of punishment.
Yes, I think there are companies that do the right thing because they believe in it. And when you think about trying to, run your operations, there are companies that do things based on values for, let's say, respect of the environment and so on. And I don't think all companies are, thinking we should just make money and let's try to take advantage of as many different aspects as possible. So there are some good examples out there. I don't think, companies are all just negative and doing bad things.
But obviously, evidence shows that some are breaking the law, breaking the rules of ethics. Do we need to have a strong system in place to catch them?
That's the big question. And when I first started teaching ethics, which was, 15 years ago, and you heard of like WorldCom crisis and so on, and then other, big scandals. And like I was saying earlier, every time I would tell my students, hopefully this is the last big bad example we hear, but we keep saying it. And what system can we put in place to make sure that those things don't happen? And I think in many ways there have been new laws, new regulations, new systems in place. But you see companies always trying to find some way around these rules. So I think just thinking of the punishment aspect, of the control aspect, doesn't work. I think we also need to reward companies for doing the right things. And like I was saying earlier, I think there are companies out there who, where they think about, what kinds of benefits can I bring to society and how can I do it in a kind of an ethical manner. And they are doing that. I think these few examples, unfortunately, show businesses in a bad light. But there are some, some companies that do good things.
Back to our callers now with Tom and Shatek. Tom, hi.
Hi, how are you? The question I have, first of all, the peanut butter guy is being held to a high standard, spending several years in jail. But the executives of General Motors, many, many more people died because of their actions. Why aren't they being held to the same standard?
Tom, thanks a lot for that. I want to give our guest time to respond. Praveen, I've seen other people pointing this out. There were deaths in the GM case. There were apparently cover-ups at the company. We didn't see two-decade-plus felony convictions.
I was chatting with one of my colleagues, and also he does some, he's a lawyer by training as well. And I think it's also a question of settlement and how easy it is for the government to go after these companies. Because I think in the case of the peanut butter company, it was the accountability that we were talking about was much more straightforward. And it is possible that the Department of Justice decided that in the GM case, that settling for some fines would be, at the end, settlements are kind of the easiest option for everyone involved. And I think in that case, that probably is what worked best.
Tom, thanks a lot for that call. We were talking about business ethics with Praveen Parbodia with UW-Whitewater. He's written books on business ethics, among other things. One thing that's changed in the world of business ethics, though, Praveen, is we have social media now. There are lots of ways where consumers can talk to each other, highlight grievances, employees too, for that matter. Does that make transparency more realistic? Does that give people ways to hold corporations' feet to the fire that we didn't used to have?
Yes, definitely. In fact, in one of the chapters in the business ethics book I have deals with social media, because there's such a big percentage of the consumers that probably don't, listen to NPR, for example, or read newspapers, and they are getting their sources of information from those outlets. And you better have a strategy in place to make sure that you are, you know, saying the right things and you're responding correctly. Otherwise, the hard work that you're doing building reputation could just be gone, because there was the case of, I think, Nestle, and there was some posting of how they were trying to, in Indonesia, how they were cutting the forest to plant palm trees for chocolate and so on. And one of their social media persons actually made fun of whoever was posting on their Facebook page, and they got in big trouble for that. So yeah, you better know, have good social media strategies, because if you don't, the types of, you know, like they say, it does spread like wildfire. If there's misinformation or if you're not being transparent, you will be in trouble.
Praveen, I imagine that there are a lot of CEOs out there watching these stories thinking, okay, I don't want to be next. I want to maybe change things if we need changes, or make sure we're all on the same page. How can somebody in that position set the culture, set up a landscape at their corporation where it's clear the kind of ethical behavior that they want, and that everybody else is going to take that up and run with it and not try to cut corners, not try to make a profit at the risk of breaking the law, breaking the bounds of ethics?
You know, like they say, it all starts at the top. I think setting the example, and it all starts with small decisions. You know, for example, if somebody is going to a conference and takes somebody else out who's not really a client, as a CEO, are you involved in such types of actions as well? I think setting the tone, but also there are so many things. You know, you can obviously train people about what is the right thing to do, and making sure that they are aware of laws and regulations. You can have code of ethics and so on. But we know that companies that have these things don't always end up doing the right things. You know, I'm sure Volkswagen has a nice set of code of ethics somewhere on the wall somewhere. I think how people live these things, and how are you supporting these things? Because I remember reading about G, for example, and they were willing to fire very good people in I believe it was in Egypt, because these employees had behaved unethically. Then you're sending the message that, yes, we do care about what's going on inside the company, and we are, you know, we will live by these rules. Because I think if you fire somebody who has incredible in-depth local knowledge that you really need, and you say that they are paying for their consequences of their actions, then you will do well. But I also think that, you know, we need to reward people who are doing the right things. And the reason why I also say that things are not as bleak is I'm also a judge for the Torch Award of the Better Business Bureau. And you see amazing examples of Wisconsin companies and all the good things they do and all the contributions they make to their community and how they treat their employees well and so on. So I think, you know, it's not as bleak.
Praveen, you say you tell your students each time there's a scandal, you hope it will be the last one. You're hoping that again this time with Volkswagen?
I hope so, but I'm sure we'll be chatting again, because like I was saying earlier, probably somebody is trying to figure out some loophole as we speak.
Praveen, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thank you so much.
That was UW-Whitewater business professor Praveen Parbodia. He joined us to talk about corporate ethics in light of recent scandals at Volkswagen and the now defunct Peanut Corporation of America.